Good morning and welcome to another International Connection. This is show number 15 in a series on mind control. This is this week we're going to be hearing part 3 of an interview I conducted with Claudia Mullen, a survivor of U.S. government mind control. Claudia describes what she remembers of the mind control experiments at Tulane University in New Orleans, starting when she was 8 years old. Claudia is alleging that the CIA and U.S. military experimented on her and other children using severe trauma, drugs, electroshock, hypnosis, and other methods to control her. She claims she was trained to sexually please men by the CIA and was used as a young child and young woman for sexual entrapment of military and government officials. This week she talks about how she was used, the doctors involved in the experiments, and the mind control project she remembers being involved with. You're listening to CKLN 88.1.
The doctors were the only ones who could save me. The doctors were my friends. I had to listen to the doctors and only them. They wouldn't name any names specifically. They would just say the doctors, the good doctors. So that all my life, I always, if anything was wrong, I always went to a doctor. You know, because this is what was ingrained in me, was the doctors were the answer to everything. And believe me, my whole life, when I wasn't going through all this stuff, I was constantly having, something would be wrong with me. I was in and out of the hospital. I had all sorts of illnesses that they never could diagnose specifically what was wrong with me. I had a history of headaches, migraine headaches my whole life. And the headaches were from the shock treatments. They give you horrible headaches. And you wake up from, you know, from getting shock treatments and your head just feels like it's going to explode. So they would get you on painkillers. And then, of course, they'd get you addicted to painkillers, so you'd have to keep going back to get more painkillers for the headaches. And I had surgeries that I found out later didn't even need to be done, but they were looking for things that were wrong with me, because I would go to other doctors, you know, and they wouldn't know anything about this. They would just, you know, I had episodes where I was vomiting constantly, couldn't keep any food down, was losing weight, and I had surgery, exploratory surgery. Never did find anything wrong with me.
Where was the surgery done on you?
Oh, in my stomach. Mm-hmm. Abdominal surgery. They took my gallbladder out, my appendix, but there was nothing wrong with them, and I kept vomiting. And what it is body pain. Body memories come back. Before the actual memory comes back, before the flashbacks come, you get the body pain first. That's the first sign that you're getting a memory. It usually starts with a headache and then like stomach ache, cramps. The actual pain of the memory without the rest of the memory, without remembering what happened, you would just get the pain part. Pain comes first. Always. Pain is a barrier to remembering, because you'd be in so much pain, you would want to get rid of the pain right away. So I would call up Dr. Brown, Charles Brown, who was the friend, you know, the one I told you about was my monitor, who was a family friend and friends with Darwin Fenner and Robert Heath, Martin Horn. And I would go to him and say, I'm having these horrible headaches again, or I'm having these cramps and they won't go away. And of course, that would be a sign to him, she's remembering. She's going to start remembering pretty soon. So then he would take me to Dr. Heath, and he'd say, well, he's going to fix me up. And he'd give me more shock treatment. And then I'd go home and forget.
He would give you electroshock.
Mm-hmm. And then painkillers for the headaches that I would get afterwards. But the body pain would go away because I'd stop remembering. Or I'd start having nightmares about snakes, weird things, and I'd go to Dr. Brown and say, I'm having these nightmares, and he would think, oh, she's going to start remembering soon, so we've got to do something. And it's usually shock that they use, but sometimes they can just use trauma. They can just traumatize you so much that you forget.
And how would they traumatize you?
It depended on what was going on at the time. Sometimes they would send me to they knew people in the city that were involved in the white supremacy groups. Sometimes they would send me out to when they had their Klan meetings, and I'd have to go to one of them at night and watch things being done to other people, and then have things done to me, you know, be raped or beaten, whatever. That's enough trauma to make you forget whatever you were starting to remember. This would make it go away. And then you'd forget this as soon as it happened, too, because nobody wants to remember something like that. One of the body's defenses, I guess, or the mind's defenses, if something really horrible happens to you, you forget it right away, usually, if it's bad enough. And then, of course, I had the personalities, and they would come out for the trauma, and then they'd go back, and so Claudia would have no memory of what just happened. My shadows would, but I wouldn't. And unless they give me the memory, then it was as if it never happened to me. I'd be sore or hurt, bruised or whatever, but I wouldn't know why. So I'd go to, you know, Dr. Brown or Dr. Heath, and they would explain to me what happened to me. And usually they would make up some story about how I tried to hurt myself. I tried to kill myself again. I thought I was suicidal my whole life because they told me I was.
Did you feel that the doctors were deliberately creating dissociation with you?
They knew that I could dissociate from the beginning, so they just caused me to dissociate even more, because the more you split, the easier it was to hide what they were doing. In other words, you can only split, they can't make you split. They can't make you dissociate. But they can create the circumstances that they know you will, if you're able to dissociate, you will. You'll do it. Like the trauma I just described, like sending me out to a Masonic lodge for a party. They would send me out, and you knew something horrible was going to happen. I mean, they knew something horrible was going to happen to me. They knew that I would split, that someone would be created just to take whatever happened that night. And probably that's all they would do. And then they would go back and, you know, go to sleep, become dormant. And these are the shadows that I was talking about that have integrated. Once they gave me the memory of, say, that experience, then they integrate. But so they create circumstances to make you split and split and split. And the more you split, of course, the less chance you have of ever healing. The more crazy you're going to sound if you ever do go to a psychiatrist or a therapist, because there was always that chance that, you know, I might get away from them and seek help from someone other than the good doctors that I knew already. There was always that chance. So they had to make you seem as crazy as possible. And, of course, the more alters you have, the more bizarre you're going to seem to people. And the more bizarre the trauma, like sending you to, to the camp that I went to across the lake that Mr. Fenner had. They would put on these ceremonies, and a lot of the times it was fake stuff. They would pretend to cut people open or kill babies. Back then, I thought it was real. I thought it was really happening. Well, if you go describe something like that about a ceremony where a baby is cut up and killed and eaten, people are going to think, you're insane, you know, this didn't happen. So they would kind of mimic satanic rituals to make it seem like that had happened, and then if I ever told anybody, they would dismiss it right away.
So you feel that these things were done basically to cover the doctor's tracks?
Oh, right, right. To make me seem, if I ever remembered, I would remember first the incest stuff, the stuff at home. And then it would gradually go from that to the ritual stuff. Rituals meaning either the satanic stuff across the lake, rituals like the white supremacy groups, the rituals that they do, burning the crosses. I mean, I actually saw them kill people, color, you know, black people. And this is like in the early, you know, early 60s. Masonic, I went to a couple of Masonic parties at a lodge that was located right near the research building. It was a research building for animal experiments in New Orleans, and it's still there, as a matter of fact. I've been back there, and they sent me there sometimes for certain tests or for experiments. And there was a Masonic lodge right around the corner from it, and they sent me to a couple of parties there. And these people just, they go crazy at these parties. These men, they just get drunk and, you know, they just pass you around, and it's horrible what they do. And this, of course, makes it seem like if I ever remember, well, I remember being at this party and these men hurting me, but I don't remember doctors being involved. I don't remember Tulane University being involved or anybody from Maryland. I remember, you know, I would remember this Masonic Lodge. And so that's how they cover their tracks.
Was it sexual abuse that was going on or other kinds of abuse at these parties?
Yes. They'd make you perform sexually. They'd make... They'd make you watch other people perform. I mean, they would have everything you can imagine, even bringing in the animals. And you had to watch, which was, it's just as bad as having it done to yourself. Sometimes watching is just as worse. I mean, just as bad.
Watching it being done to other people. Children? Or?
Yeah, especially if it's people younger than yourself. You're a child, and you have to stand there and watch a little kid who's half your age being tortured or raped or whatever. I mean, that's just as bad as having it done to yourself. Mm-hmm. You'd almost rather it be done to you because it's you know what it's like, and you don't want to watch it. And then they would give you the choice, well, you can take a place. And then you'd have to make the decision whether it's going to be you or her. And if you decided not to do it, well, then you have to live with the guilt that it happened to someone else because you decided not to do it. But they had you either way you looked at it. I mean, you're screwed either way, literally. Mm. I mean, there was no way out of any of these situations.
And when you remembered this lodge, did you make attempts to verify if it was where it was? And
yeah, we went there. Mm-hmm. We went to the lodge and talked to people. It's not a lodge anymore. It's a public health building, actually, now. But yeah, we talked to people that had been there, and they said, yeah, it was a Masonic lodge at one time. So Valerie and I went there. We went to Camp Nichols, which I said is a police training ground now, but they said it was an arsenal at one time. And we went in the room where I stayed when I was there. And they did some kind of bizarre thing with me there. I guess I was about 8. I was taken there, and there was 2 other children that I was put with, a boy and a little girl, about 5 years old. And they would do things like, I guess just to traumatize you, they would do things sexual to you or physically, you know, hurt you, beat you, whatever. And then they would say, well, we're going to choose one person, or you have to choose somebody which person's going to live or die, you know, the boy or the girl. They would give you choices like that, and I mean, impossible situations. And then, you know, they go through the motions as if they would take one of the kids outside and kill them. And you thought that they would, you know, and they didn't. I'm sure they didn't. I'm sure it was just a like a play they put on. But it was just to put you through this these mind games, you know, just, I don't know, just to mess up your, I don't know what they were doing, but it was trauma, I know that. And by the time they finished, you didn't know whether you were coming or going. It just seemed so bizarre, and, you know, if I had ever remembered it before now, before I had a good therapist to help me, and who validated the fact that these things do happen, you know, anybody else would think you're crazy, and they'd lock you up and throw away the key.
And I think that was their intent on, it oh, seems yeah. that incorporating...
And there was a lot of messages that they gave you over the years that if you did start remembering all this, the guilt would be so bad that you'd have to kill yourself. And they were hoping that by now I had killed myself. And I haven't. They're pretty pissed off about it, the people that are left.
Did you feel that they were using this trauma to create dissociation for other purposes than just kind of hiding the fact that they were doing the experiments on you?
I think they were doing it also just to see what they could do. They could take a child's mind, and how much, what could they actually do? How much could they cause her to split? How many times? Or how much could they do to somebody and how quickly they could forget it? Just to see what could be done, I think. Just for the hell of it, I guess.
Or perhaps that was part of the experimentation itself?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, they had a lot of different projects. Mm-hmm. It wasn't all sexual stuff. I mean, you know, there were a lot of projects that were just about mind control, that were, they had these names for these projects that were, you'd never know what the project was really about, because, sensitive research, that was a part of the operational side of the CIA, and there was a department called sensitive research. Well, it was sexual stuff, but, you know, sensitive research, that could be just about anything, right? And Uncle Richard was head of the sensitive research department, or the dirty tricks department, he called it. Uncle Richard turned out to be, after I described him and had a lot of memories of him, I found out from one of the experts that his name was Helms, Richard Helms.
And he was the CIA director at
certain point. When I knew him, he was the deputy. Mm-hmm. They called him the deputy. I remember being impressed because I loved cowboys and cowboy movies and stuff. And so when he told me he was a deputy, that's all I heard was the word deputy. And I thought, a deputy like in the Old West. And I was real impressed with him. And he didn't really molest me or do anything to me until I got to be about 13. And then he started, all of a sudden, it was, call me Uncle Richard. You know, before that, he pretty much would dismiss me or just talk around me or not pay any attention to me. And I always was really impressed by this person because he seemed to have a lot of power and everybody seemed to listen to what he said. He dressed like in the most expensive clothes. He always looked really nice. He had everybody waiting on him hand and foot. And so he was just like an impressive man. And I always was in kind of awe of him. And then all of a sudden, when I'm about ready to turn 13, he starts paying attention to me. And that really impressed me. You know, I thought, I must really be special. You know, this guy says, call me Uncle Richard now. And it turns out, I guess he liked teenage girls, he didn't like children. And he would purposely take me to places that he knew they didn't have cameras, because of course he knew all about the camera stuff, the filming, because he was partly, one of the people who thought of it.
Mm-hmm.
Gottlieb.
I wonder if we could go through the people that you have mentioned in your testimony, and if we could talk one by one about what exactly they were involved in the experimentation. Maybe we could start with Sidney Gottlieb.
Okay. Sidney Gottlieb, he's one of the first people that I remember from when I was 8 years old. He was there from the beginning. He told me he worked for the agency. They always referred to themselves as the agency. When they meant the CIA, they called themselves the agency. And they made no secret of the fact that it was the CIA, but and sometimes they would, you know, I would overhear or they would tell me what department they were from. And he was in the science and technology department, he said. He worked very closely with Martin Orne, a Dr. Stephen Aldrich, and the Morse man, I called him. And apparently he and the Allen, Morse Allen, had been working together since this whole thing started in the late 40s, early 50s. And they were very good friends, and Gottlieb was very good friends with Richard Helms, too, which was kind of odd because they were like complete opposites of each other. And they seemed like totally like people who could never get along with each other, yet they were really good friends. He had a lot to do with radiation. He had a lot to do with any kind of research. And like I said, I remember him a lot from when I was little and all the way till, I guess, through the time I was in high school. And then after that, I didn't see him much. I didn't hear about him very much. I don't know where he went or what he was doing. He must have been involved in something else.
So about how many years was he involved in what happened to you?
From the time I was about 8 till 16, about 8 years. And he told me that he raised goats. And, they would talk about themselves sometimes. It was amazing. These people would just, you know, as if, I guess they figured I wasn't going to remember anything when I left, wherever I was. So they were just free to talk, and sometimes they just liked to brag about themselves. And so that's how I would remember so much about them. Because they were arrogant. Most of them were very arrogant people, and they liked you to know how important they were or how many kids they had or how much power they had. So they would say what their title was or something to impress you, I guess, thinking the whole time that she's not going to remember anything, or thinking they're talking to a child who doesn't even understand the words they're using, not knowing that years later I'm going to remember the same words and understand their meaning. See, they're thinking that they're telling this to an 8-year-old who doesn't have a clue what the words mean, but never thinking that I was going to remember later on.
Right.
So.
Now, you mentioned Dr. Ewan Cameron.
Yes.
Was specifically involved in the electroshock. Do you have a sense of how long of a period he was involved with your experimentation?
Well, they called him, a lot of them they called them consultants. They would consult them on, Dr. Heath or Dr. Green would say, let's call you and Cameron in to test her. And then the next thing I knew, I would be called back to Tulane, and here was this man, the cameraman. And he came in, I guess, when I was about around 1960, when I was about 10, 9 or 10, I guess. And he was there a lot at first, testing, you know, how much electricity it took to make me forget, how much was too much, or how much, you know, I mean, they didn't want to fry my brain or anything because they needed me to seem fairly intelligent, I guess, so I could, you know, associate with people. I had to go back to school, and so they had to be very careful when they used stuff on me, and they couldn't disfigure me. I guess I was lucky in that sense that I was in school. I was in a private girls' school. I was from a wealthy family, and they had to send me back home. And my family wasn't really involved in it, per se. My mother knew they were using me, but she didn't know for what. So they had to send me back in fairly good condition. And so that made me one of the lucky ones, because there were others that were from homeless families or, you know, poor families where they didn't care what condition they sent the kid back or if they even sent the child back at all. And they used things on them that would disfigure them, and it didn't matter. But I guess in my case, I was fortunate. And another thing, Dr. Heath wanted to implant something in my brain, and Mr. Fenner wouldn't let him because he said, how am I going to explain this to her mother? I can't send her home with her head shaved. So I got out of having implants in my brain because of that. So anyhow, you asked me about Cameron, though. I knew him from about, 1959 or 60. And then when I was in high school, I was told one day, just out of the blue, someone said, oh, he fell off a mountain. He's not coming. Somebody named Cleghorn is coming to take his place to do the electric shocks. And I was told years later, that, yeah, as a matter of fact, he was mountain climbing or something, or skiing, and he fell off a mountain and died. So that was true, what they told me.
And did you have a sense of who this Cleghorn person was?
He worked with the Cameron very closely. I guess he was from the same place. He liked to use electricity, only he thought that Cameron didn't use enough. He believed in using a lot more. And he was not very... He didn't try to get along with you or act friendly in any way. He was very cold. And whereas Cameron, at least, would talk to you and, attempt to be friendly. Some of them were like that. Some of them would, introduce themselves or ask you questions. And others just did what they had to do and got out of there and never said a word. But
so about how many years did you come in contact with Dr. Cameron? From about 59 to 60 until when?
So I think it was when I was about 16, so 16 and a half, so that would be 1966.
So about six, 67
years? When I was told that he had fallen off a mountain. I know I was in high school. I know I was in the latter part of high school, so it had to be around 66 or 67. And the thing I was telling you about the messages that he would give me, that he would record and then they would play at night,
mm-hmm.
He called it something called psychic driving.
Right.
But that's what the message is called. But I don't remember him after like 66 or 67. I think that was the last I saw of him.
And Martin Orn, what was his involvement?
Gosh, horrible. He was one of the scariest people. He worked with Dr. Brown, who was my monitor, at the NIH in the 50s, and they were good friends, and he said he was an expert in lie detection, and that he could always tell if someone was lying, that he had invented the lie detector or something. I don't know. I'm sure he is a very arrogant person, and he thinks a lot of himself, and so I'm sure he told me a lot of lies about what he could do and what he couldn't do, Well, there wasn't anything he couldn't do, supposedly. He could tell whenever you were lying. He hated everyone. He didn't get along with hardly anyone. He called me the little bitch. That was his nickname for me. He wouldn't even call me by name. And he mainly did hypnosis-type stuff. He was always there for the shock treatments. If nothing else, just to watch. he would hook me up to, you know, when they asked me questions, he would be the one to tell them whether I was lying or not, and he'd have me hooked up to a couple of machines and have electrodes on my head, and he said he could read the machines and tell them whether I was lying or not. I guess it was like a lie detector, I don't know. And he's still alive, you know, in Philadelphia. Well, I spoke to him. I called him. He was one of the people I called because I remembered him. Before I started getting all his memories back, I remembered Dr. Heath, of course, Dr. Brown, but I remembered this Martin Orne.